Blog Talk Radio.
Culture, ideology, and identity. We're sort of picking up where we left off last week. Got a little bit sidetracked last week, but that's okay. We had a good discussion. We'd like to encourage people to call in again tonight. You know, even if conversation does get sidetracked, as long as it's good, that's great. So if you feel compelled, please call in. So we sort of left off last week with this sort of molded working definition of culture. We had a few different ideas to work with. But we all sort of seem to say that culture is what nurtures us or raises us in sort of like an agricultural sense, like we're growing wheat. Radia, a caller from last week, seemed to think that culture sort of sustains an ideology. And then later Hope and Radia made a claim that culture is a group's attempts to satisfy its needs, whether it's ritual, cuisine, religion, that those sort of cultural artifacts come about to fill some need we have as humans. Now, I don't know if we were good with those or not. Maybe Nick has an opinion on the matter. But we narrowed down some interesting aspects of culture. One of them was that some parts of culture seem ubiquitous on a worldwide sense. We decided that things like love, food, shelter, those are needs that humans have that are universal, that we all have, that we seem to want to say a person is abnormal if they don't have those needs. Was there anything else you wanted to say about universal culture, Nick?
No, I think that's pretty good. The whole idea of it being ubiquitous and connected through all culture of humans, yeah.
It seems like a distinction was kind of an important feature of culture, too. I mean, we noted that when we identify culture in a conversational sense, it's usually in distinction. We sort of talk about culture in regards to specific ethnic backgrounds. We talk about Mexican foods or Caribbean music or British humor or things like that. We sort of identify an ethnic or cultural background and then point out how it's different from others. So I guess we've got sort of those two important features to work with. Was there anything else we said about culture that we need to rehash, Nick?
No, but this thought just came to me, so I'll throw it out there. So we have the universal culture and the individual culture, and it seems like a normal conversation that in order, the way we use culture is we're speaking about it in the individual sense. I know I'm just reiterating here, but I was thinking that the universal culture is not so much, we don't think of it when we talk about culture because we have nothing to really distinguish ourselves from some other species that is like so much like ourselves, and that's just, you know, some speculative thought on why it's the case that we don't talk about culture in the universal sense of humanity. But maybe provided there were some aliens that were sentient beings that we were communicating with, we could look at the difference between alien culture and human culture. But in the sense, human culture seems to, as we're calling it, as universal culture, is maybe what we should call universal human culture or something like that. But just, you know, another distinction to be made, I guess, is just drawing that idea out further. But that's all I have to say about that.
No, I think you're absolutely right there, that if we had something else to compare it to, we might not talk about American culture versus European culture. We might talk about, like, Earth culture versus Martian culture or something of that nature. But
right.
I think you might even find ecologists or sort of the biologists who are interested in animal behavior, behavioral ecologists of the animal kingdom. I don't know how to say that. You might hear them talking about things like deer culture or bovine culture or something of that nature.
Mm.
I mean, they might be
right.
A bit uppity by, right, but you could hear that.
So do you think I guess this would be a speculative question because, you know, we're both not really well-trained in biology, you know, aside from the, you know, basic university courses in biology. But so do you think that if a biologist were to be talking about deer culture, that they would be describing the behaviors and the social interactions between deers?
I do think that they would definitely be describing the social interaction between deers. That's exactly what I would think.
Okay, I mean, I just think it's interesting because I think where we're going next is, and correct me if I'm wrong, that kind of how culture amongst humans and the individual culture informs the ideology. Now, we still need to kind of flesh out what the ideology is, but it seems to be that there's a distinction between the animals, or I shouldn't say the animals, I don't know, lower species. I hate putting us on a hierarchy because I don't really think that, never mind, that's a whole other conversation.
Well, you don't mean it in a pejorative context. You sort of mean like non-humans, like the other species, right?
Right. And the fact that a biologist wouldn't talk about a deer's ideology, you know, because it wouldn't be able to express itself. So another distinction, I guess, is that the humans separate themselves with something which we're calling ideology that we still, I think, haven't really gotten much into. But so yeah, ideology, is that where you were planning on going?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we spent quite a bit of time fleshing out what is and isn't culture last show, and we sort of just bridged on ideology. You mentioned that culture informs ideology. I think that's a good way to say it. Radia mentioned last week that culture furthered ideology, that sort of ideology was the goal at which culture aims. I'm not sure that those were her words, but I think that I'd be comfortable heading that direction, saying that the ultimate goal of culture seems to be sort of arriving at an ideology or at least sustaining an ideology. I don't know if you're comfortable with that or not.
Yeah, I am insofar as, you know, because you have, you know, like in the 60s, you know, these vast changes in ideology, you know, revolutionary changes in ideology, the way that people think. And so, I don't know, I guess to recognize that there's, I guess with what you said, I was inferring something that shouldn't have been inferred. I was thinking that you were saying that ideology doesn't, or culture doesn't change ideology, and it seems, wait, because you said culture sustains ideology, right?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, it's certainly open to debate.
Right, yeah, I was just trying to build on whatever you were just saying. It kind of got lost in my train of thought, but...
It's totally okay. Yeah, I think Radia wanted to say that that culture at least sustained ideology, if not created it. And I think I would like to take a step out there and say that culture does sort of create ideology. You know, if we were to make a working definition of ideology the way we did with culture as you know, what its mechanics are, I think we might say that ideology is something like, in fact, I think someone did say this, although unfortunately I didn't write it down, that ideology is like a set of norms that we agree upon or something to that nature, that it's the
right
needs that we're filling with culture, if that makes sense. And
okay,
I think,
yeah,
I'm comfortable with that. I think that that makes sense. I mean, I don't know that we'd say that we ever sat down at like a Continental Congress for ideology, you know, and took a vote on what was good or bad or that sort of thing. But it does seem that there is some sort of unspoken social contract with regards to normative judgments or ethics or that sort of thing.
Right, which is an interesting thing. So I guess I was thinking about, so does ideology, if it's kind of this, because I was thinking along the same lines that ideology is this unspoken kind of way that we think, but is there any like justification that happens, or are these beliefs just kind of instilled in us through, you know, repetitive, you know, sayings and people kind of talking about it, but the justification itself isn't really spoken of? I don't know if that's the case or not, but I was just trying to think of where does justification fit into this, if at all,
well,
into the ideology or the social norms, as we seem to be kind of dubbing it.
Right. That's an interesting question. We actually have a caller. I don't know if they'll be able to shed light on that or not, but we'll certainly see. Caller, welcome to the show.
Hi, you guys. This is Radia.
Hi, Radia.
Hey, Radia. How you doing?
I'm doing excelente, Facente.
Good. I've sort of been quoting you fast and loose here, so I'm glad you're here to speak for yourself.
Well, I heard a little bit about what you said, and ideologies becoming the norm from the way that I perceive it is the result of the creation of ideology and culture, meaning that ideology, from my perspective, is a way in which one sees or perceives the world. And due to that vision, cultural artifacts are created in order to uphold that ideology within a particular societal structure. It becomes the norm because of the simple fact it becomes ritualized, it becomes a part of nature. The individual, the dominant culture or society that is running ideology runs, I guess you could say, a ritual sense of repetition. So therefore, in the mind of the viewer, it becomes normalized, it becomes a part of nature, it becomes a part of oneself. I'll give you a example of what I mean. When they talk about ideology in culture, and as far as media studies and the way things become normalized, when you look at the ideology of race, you look at the ideology of gender, when you see the, I guess you could say, aristocratic older ideology of the female and male archetype and what they think it should be, you see that in media artifacts, and it is constantly run. For example, this is not really pertaining to today, but maybe in the 1950s, the woman being in the home and the male working, Leave It to Beaver and all of those shows. So the particular ideologies of the person at the top of the pyramid is filtered into media artifacts and is completely run at a ritualistic pace. Therefore, the viewer takes that in and it becomes a cultural artifact of the mass group, mass society, and it replicates itself in the real 3D reality, if that makes sense. It becomes normalized. It becomes the norm. It becomes accepted. And anyone who goes against that ideology becomes the black sheep.
Right, so when you were talking about this, go ahead, Mike, sorry.
No, it's all right. You first.
So when you were talking about that, I kept on thinking in my mind, so where, I don't think you really answered, like, where does it come from? Like, you have these media artifacts that represent some sort of reality of what is the social norm. So you can look at artifacts back in the 1800s and determine, well, you know, in England what the view of colonizing Africa was, or you know, you can start to get a picture of what the social norms were back then based on the literature and art that was available. But I'm still curious, and when I listened, you said like the man on top or the person in power, I don't know exactly the words that you used, was where that the ideology actually comes from. So you know, it's like,
well,
where does it come from? So, is that what you're saying?
Oh, absolutely. When you look, you know, when I was a media student at NYU, you looked at the hegemony, you looked at the corporate ladder, and who sits at the top of the ladder. This is changing, you know, because we're progressing into a different time, but the majority of corporations, who sat at the top of the pyramid? It was white, male, I don't know if I should say Christian or Puritan-like type of ideologies, because it was exactly what I just said. So those thought forms, those ideologies, and the way that they perceive the world trickles down the ladder, trickles down the pyramid, and filters in to whatever media artifacts are produced out into American society. They have the same type of view. Hard for some people to believe, but that is how the hegemony works, how dominant culture works. So it does come from that, exactly. And it does morph over time because, as I just stated, more women are coming into those positions of CEO, and many different types of people. It's changing, and you can see that through the media artifacts. There's an old saying, you can tell a lot by a society and what they fear, what they love, what they think is valued through media artifacts. You can tell a lot. You don't even have to go to the country, but if you watch a movie or you read a book, you can tell a lot about how that society thinks from a religious standpoint, a gender standpoint, a family standpoint, meaning the family structure and how that's constructed in their view. You can see all that in their media artifacts. And you can also see how it's changed through time. And the reason why it changes is because of the simple fact that, I guess you could say, the thoughts at the top of the pyramid changes, trickles down, and it's tested on humanity to see whether they will accept it or not. For example, the gay issue, the gay marriage, you know, thing, and seeing gay individuals on television, you wouldn't have seen that in the 1950s. It just,
definitely not.
You definitely would not have seen that, and people wouldn't have accepted that. You wouldn't have seen teen pregnancy in the 1950s. You wouldn't have seen, like, these whole Jason Killer type of movie, slasher, and things of this nature, and teens having sex on the tube. You just, people would have been in an uproar. You know what I mean? So ideology can change through time. The artifacts can change through time. I think that there are certain structures of ideologies that don't change, but when it comes to cultural identity, those things do change. Other identities don't change. I think that they remain the same.
Sometimes, Radia, I wonder if perhaps you receive a copy of our outline before the show, because you seem to hit on many of the topics that we plan to cover. So, I don't know, are you hacking my email? I don't know how that works.
Sweetie, it's called ESP.
Right.
It's called spiritual connection, honey. Me tapping into your auric field. No, I'm just kidding. No, I just love talking about these things.
No,
because
absolutely.
Yeah, it's fascinating how it all works, how it all comes together, how we become into being. Because we don't notice them. Like I said, because they're ritualized in media artifacts through books, through comic books, through movies, through television shows, through billboards. They become a part of nature, even though they are not. So we don't notice them. We take, you know, the assumption for granted. We don't notice them, but they become a part of who we are, how we interact with ourselves, how we interact in our relationships one-on-one, and how we act in group relationships. So it's very much important. Tells a lot.
Right. Unfortunately, I haven't been taking notes. There's a few things you said we'd like to come back specifically, such as the aristocracy, or some being tradition while others are new, and this sort of thing. But specifically to the point we were getting at previously, the question of justification. It seems as though you said, and I think you're right about this, that when it comes to traditional culture, things like patriarchy, man being the head of the household, etc., I think the justification why people like you or I or Nick, assuming we do accept these, I think the justification for why we accept them is that it's the way it's been. And as you pointed out, you know, if someone sort of questions that, then they're a deviant. If someone sort of questions, you know, the traditional ideology and why it's being furthered by our culture, then they're sort of labeled as like a rabble-rouser, a problem maker. Now, of course, you know, that's not always the case, because things such as that are changing. And you sort of mentioned how ideology can filter down through the aristocracy. I'm not sure I'm totally convinced with all your points, but when you talked about like advertising, I do think that's interesting, because when you think about like the upcoming of sex appeal in advertising, I think you'd be hard-pressed not to argue that that was a conscious decision by sort of the CEO, you know, corporate types to try and sell more product. I think you're probably exactly right about that, that it was a conscious advertising decision that was made, and that because it became repetitive and we were exposed to it, it became accepted. It's just sort of like, oh, okay, well, that's now the way the world is.
Well, let me tell you a little secret. I am in the marketing industry. And marketing organizations purposefully, since the inception of television and a little bit previously, worked with sociologists and psychologists on your psyche. Therefore, what I'm saying is, if there's a traditional formula when you're in school and you're learning marketing, there's like a traditional formula of how to deal with the psyche of the human being. And what do they play on? They play on your insecurity to monetize your feelings, your emotions in order to make money. Know this. Marketers will not tell you that, but they study the psychology, the thinking process, the mental process of human beings and what their vulnerabilities are and how they can play onto that for the benefit of making money. Absolutely. If you don't have, you know, if you're not beautiful, you're not going to get a date and get married. If you don't brush your teeth, no one's going to like you. If you don't buy this BMW, the woman of your dreams is not going to come by. She's not going to want you because you don't have the capabilities to support her financially. These are like ingrained, should I say, secret insecurities of individuals in society, of being able to measure up, not only to themselves, but to their colleagues, to their families, to society as a whole. You are measured by things. Why is this? Because during the medieval times, what people based worth upon were things. You see this in paintings. Most of the people who had paintings and things of this nature, and what they base pictures like visual advertising on is the aristocratic class. And when you study art history, they show you how certain paintings came into be and how they were used by the aristocratic class, because the only people who were painting and writing and getting education during that time, because they were the only ones who could afford it, were the wealthy. They were running the show. So because the wealth are the one, you know, the wealthy individuals run this country, they have been inbred and ingrained with this aristocratic way of thinking, which the average person would not truly understand, but you don't get these things until you go to college and you start learning the history, and you're like, wow, that's deep. It's very much profound. So you're correct.
Now, you convinced.
What? What's that?
Are you convinced?
Am I convinced? Oh, man. In a sense, I guess. You know, I just watched one of my favorite movies again last night, which is Good Will Hunting. And I don't know. In a sense, I see there's a scene where, Robin Williams is sitting down with Matt Damon. And if you haven't seen the movie, check it out. It's really good. But he says, like, do you think I have any understanding of you because I've read Oliver Twist? You know, and we were talking about media artifacts as this ideology, and, you know, or you could read, Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. Does that give you an understanding of what colonialized Africa was like? And it's like, well, the ideology, I think, is so much removed from what's real, and I feel that a lot of people can actually distinguish themselves from the ideology, you know, and I'm having a hard time of figuring out what is the mechanism that causes somebody, or I don't know, you know, cause and effect is a tricky beast. So I don't know if I want to go there. But what is the mechanism behind being able to remove yourself from that ideology? Is it understanding, like Radia was saying, like, you know, when you're in college and you're learning these things? I just had a literary and cultural theory class where I learned about the cultural movement and looking at media artifacts and through the paradigm of what effect they have on ideology and what it says about the society in which these media artifacts are being portrayed. And, you know, it did. It really opened up my eyes, and I was like, wow, you know, look at all this stuff and look what it's saying about me and about all these other things. And then another side of me says, well, you know, it only goes so far into the human psyche, and it goes back to the point that I kind of in a roundabout way of what I was trying to say with the Robin Williams' point to Matt Damon, you know, do you think I have any idea who you are because I read Oliver Twist? And it's like, no, I don't think we fit into these narrow boxes of ideology as I think the cultural movement or the cultural turn in looking at things would kind of really focus us in on and say, no, you're just a product of this and that. You know, I don't think we're fully engaged in that. I don't think I'm encapsulated by some, you know, suburban white boy book. I don't even know if one exists because it might be kind of boring. But in any case, I don't know. That was just a ramble for me, and then I don't know if I really said anything there. But
no, you did. You did, and I don't fit into the box either. It really opened up my eyes, and there's an excellent book called Ways of Seeing by John Berger. Berger. And
so Berger is spelled B-E-R-G-E-R?
Yes, he talks about advertising. He talks about the historical basis of where a lot of the art of media artifacts, the things that you see in your environment, but more in particularly towards advertising and marketing, he really gives you a historical breakdown of the images you see, why they exist in this paradigm today, and things of this nature, and how the institution plays upon that. They play upon your insecurities as a human being in order to monetize that. And that being said, I don't believe, I don't fit into the norm. I'm a rebel, honey. I'm the black sheep. So
I'd like to think of myself as such, but you know, I do acquiesce to authority, to use a fancy word. But you know, at some point. But in any case, keep going.
No, I do to a certain extent. But because I'm a cognitive thinker, and I'm like, wait a minute, I'm not going to get into it here, but as I say, I'm not a part of the sheeple groupthink. Groupthink can be very wonderful. It can be very enriching because all of our perspectives are ideas in collaboration. But in another sense, it could be quite damaging to society if you don't know who you really are. I know who I am. I know what I like, and I know when I'm being bamboozled. But and half of the reason is because I went to school and I understand the historical base, and I understand sort of to an extent the purpose behind the illusion, because this is an illusion to a certain extent, and I'm not saying from a spiritual sense, I'm saying from a real 3D sense, meaning the way that they get people to consume, to buy, to all in the name of money. It's very fascinating.
Yeah, it is pretty pretty intense when you look at the great machine kind of working itself. But you mentioned education as kind of like the thing that propelled you away from this, I don't know how to describe it, because it seems like we're talking about ideology in a fairly negative connotation and describing it as it's kind of this evil that's not allowing you to be an individual. I guess we should stop there. Is that always the case? I mean, is ideology always have this kind of negative stigma, or is there a way in which ideology kind of operates on a healthy level and, I mean, does what we would hope it would do and help each other find their own identity and all that jazz?
Oh, no, no. Nothing is never all negative and nothing is ever all positive. Ideology can be a beautiful thing. For example, are the ideology of intelligence, of communion, of speaking. We're doing it right now. When I was in college, let me tell you, I had some awesome debates with media people, and individuals who had worked with Noam Chomsky, who everybody knows. He's a genius. So, you know, no. Ideology can be beautiful, but it also, because it's in the benefit, as Hope was saying previously, in the benefit of humanity, to expand your brain cells, to get a better understanding of things that are shared ideas and get new perspectives. But it can be negative when it's in a sense of self-serving variables to gain for self. That's when I think that ideology becomes dangerous. It becomes very de-evolutionizing for the human being. because people can be so entrenched in it and not even realize that their mind and their thoughts are not their own. It's something that they have taken in and been told to be. There's a great movie called Network. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie. It was made in 1972. And it, when I tell you, it is one of the greatest movies. And there's a scene in the movie when one of the characters is saying, he's talking about society, and he's like, "You guys are crazy. You guys get everything from the tube. You look like the tube. You do what you eat what the tube tells you to eat. You live like the tube. You guys are maniacs." When I tell you, it's like one of those classic media. It's like one of the films that I studied in my undergraduate. It is like one of the best scenes in this movie, because what he is saying about society in the corporate genre is so right on point. It's like sickening. It's one of those scenes where you just want to stand up in the movie theater and you're like, "Right on, brother, right on." Because he's breaking it down about media and like the tube and like what we get from the tube. It's like the altar of humanity. Think about it. People sit in front of the tube every night and watch American Idol and all of these other things. There's nothing wrong with that, but they're mesmerized. Their mental capacity is mesmerized by those ideologies and what is coming out of that. It's very fascinating and a little scary at the same time.
Well, I have a few things to say about the upshot of ideology, and I think Regia hit the nail on the head, and she talked about the dangers of ideology. It's unfortunate we keep hitting the downside, but you gave the Hitler example last show, and I think that's just a perfect example of where ideology can go wrong. As you said, when people don't question it, they sort of just become like an unthinking or uncognitive follower of an ideology. But we have another caller, so we're going to hear them and see what they have to say. Caller, welcome to the show. We're hoping you can provide us an upshot of ideology.
Hi, this is me.
Hey.
I just want to say that I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And Radia, you know what that means. It's from Network. And it is an awesome, awesome movie.
I knew you would know that movie, Holly.
And that's why I'm telling you, you need to watch Judgment at Nuremberg. So there you go. But I just want to also say that I am in a culture where I just went down to the city center today. And the cultural artifact that everybody goes to see in the city center is called the Mannequin Piss, which is this little boy peeing. You have to I'm serious. Like, this is where everybody goes to see it, and even we wanted to go see it. See, and this is like this unreflecting, you know, and so we've been watching tapes and reading books, and you have to go see this Mannequin Piss. So we couldn't find it, and we went to the police officer, and I said, "Do you get asked this question a lot?" He says, "Every day, that's all anybody wants to see is this little boy peeing." But anyway, I just wanted to throw that in, and I wanted to say that this discussion about advertising and the methods that advertisers use, once again, it seems to imply the existence of this universal these universal needs, right? So advertisers play on this fact that we do have needs to be loved. That's one of the things we talked about last week. Accepted, revered, admired, those sorts of things. And so advertisers seem to be aware of these needs. And because they have their own selfish way of attempting to satisfy those needs for us through consumption, like we believe that if we buy such and such, as Radia was saying, our needs will be satisfied. Well, in the end, you know, that does not happen. They, and it's also like, what's motivating the advertisers? This need for wealth and superiority, is that universal, or is that a symptom of something going wrong? And I just wanted to ask anybody, if they've heard of the term meme, that's M-E-M-E. Anybody hear of that term ever?
As in like an internet meme?
Yes, like an internet meme.
Yeah, I'm familiar.
Okay. Anybody else? Radia? Nick?
Yeah, you mentioned it to me. I think it's something along the lines of, like, and I could be way wrong, but that people all, like, having this, it's kind of like a buzz think thing, like everybody kind of thinks something together. I don't know.
Yeah, it's kind of like the idea of a gene, but it's an idea that replicates itself, right? So, like, patriarchy, or when you come to Brussels, you have to see the mannequin piss. That's a meme. Like, realize there's all this other amazing architecture around here, but yet, okay, that's what everybody goes to see. So it's these ideas that replicate themselves through much like the process of natural selection. And I wanted to mention this because it seems like when we're talking about ideology and what is destructive and what's not destructive, there is this process of quote-unquote selection, whether it's natural is another question, because there's this question of, well, who's controlling the selection? And if you have advertisers doing it without a reflective society, then you have that controlling the reproduction of the idea. But going back to Radhi was talking about back in medieval times, people identified themselves through stuff and through wealth. And we do the same thing. And I wanted to, you know, say also that the break between what's called the Homeric conception of virtue that was caused by the classical philosophers, that is Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, was this movement away from the idea of saying, okay, well, what value is having stuff, to what value is the possession of inner resources, like the capacity to reason and have one's desires controlled by reason and things like this. And that, those, as you guys know, those ideas are thousands of years old. and they seem to be reproducing themselves in small circles. But in any case, they've stuck around, and I think that they're very healthy for people who encounter them. And I wanted to just connect that with our discussion about William James from a couple weeks ago, because he was talking about truth as truth is not truth in the correspondence theory, but ideas that reproduce and stick around in a way that they help the human species to evolve to a healthier state. And that's all I have to say.
That's it, hey, just that.
Just that, and, you know, the mannequin piss is overrated, okay? Like, okay, if you ever go to, like, go see it just to see it. I found it funny to watch the people watching it. That was what I was looking at, so. Anyway.
Well,
sorry, a bit of a tangent.
No, not at all. I'm assuming that everybody's just sort of taking this for granted, and that's why no one said it. You mentioned, you give us yet another example of, I don't know if I'd say pejorative, but a sense in which ideology could operate subpar. And as you mentioned, there's sort of this selective process that takes place or may not take place. And there might be a reflective society which sort of questions them as they arrive, or it might be sort of like a Hitler-type situation where there is a select group feeding propaganda, which sort of just repeats itself, and since they're the ones plastering it on the walls, there is no selection, it just gets accepted. But I just sort of wanted to point out, as like the light at the end of the tunnel, that ideology in the traditional sense, you know, very often comes from this successful, reflective selection process, even if it's not the best, but it sort of, in my opinion, provides like a launch pad with which to start, because obviously, you know, there's like a tabula rasa when we sort of come out of the womb. We don't have preconceived notions, I don't think, at 1 year old about abortion or, you know, advanced ethical questions. I think that sort of needs to be developed and then sustained over time. You know, whether or not the solutions we've decided for those questions are correct, you know, whole nother question. But certainly it provides, as the example goes, a ship with which to start. You know, we can sort of build on it from there. If anyone has anything to say
about that's cool. And so we start with this sort of like data to work on or something like that. Is that what you're saying? So like the impulse, I think what you're saying, like the impulse to create the ideology in the first place is this sort of like creative, good brainstorming activity that is natural to human beings. And it may not be correct, but there's something that's, you know, good behind it. And what I would say is, one of the ways that ideology gets transmitted, you know, from one generation to generation, how a meme replicates itself is through the pointing out of, you know, what's in philosophy called the particular, so that when we have this general notion of happiness, right, we point, like this is how you teach children language, it's called an ostensive definition. It starts with pointing. And so, you know, the child sees a brown furry thing running and mother says dog. And then the child starts to distinguish dogs from cats, and that's all well and good. But when you get into more complex terms like, you know, virtuous or happy, you know, it matters what things the culture is pointing to that, you know, represent those ideas. And that's, I think, where we can get, you know, go awry, that if we're just unreflectingly applying these ideologies that have been left to us, right? I mean, because I think that, I mean, at some point maybe we'll talk about Marx, but, you know, you could definitely say that the people who implemented Marxist ideas did so in a way that, you know, is destructive. And that's different from the question of whether the ideas work when they're, quote-unquote, applied in the right way. I've heard both arguments given. The ideas are good, they've just been wrongly applied, versus no, the ideas are just bad in and of themselves. But there's this question of application. What I'm saying is we have, you know, these principles that have, like, been passed down to us. And so part of the process of transmission, if you will, is, like, the application and the pointing. Like, the pointing to, I mean, I don't know, who is revered by teens today. I can tell you in Europe, there's, you know, Us Weekly all over the place, but the European version, I mean, it's amazing to me that they have that over here. I just wasn't expecting that to be over here, but it is. And they have their own fascination with celebrities, and the attention is there. And it's like, we believe that they have something that's worth having, and we try to emulate that. And I think that that's where we go wrong.
No, Hope, I was going to say that what you're saying, describing, it's almost, I'm thinking that ideology is like structuralism to a certain extent. It's like this, I guess you could say, map. And what leads you to certain places, I guess you could say, that the cultural artifacts and things of this nature, what holds the structure in place are the cultural artifacts and things of this nature.
And I think, like, the people doing the pointing, most of all, are the advertisers and the marketers.
Yeah.
I mean, they're the ones doing the pointing, and so we're raised to be identifying these ideas that are extremely important to human beings, like happiness and well-being and whatnot. We're raised to identify those words with things that don't really correspond, I would say. So, sorry, that's it.
What kind of, I don't know, has been on my mind this entire time, you know, very interesting conversation. I think, and the whole connecting, I just want to point out that connecting the ideology with the actual action is huge, because it's like, yes, ideology serves as this abstract kind of way that we think, but has, in a large sense, an effect on our actions. And I guess that's what makes it so either great or terrible. But what I find phenomenal, at least in my circle of people that I interact with, is the separations in ideology, particularly in the political spectrum. I just find it just radically, these people who are severely opposed from each other, and in a large part, neither of them can explain why. which I just find really funny. And it's not like their geography is a whole lot different, or even their upbringing sometimes can be damn near identical, but their ideology is just so opposed. And I have a hard time figuring out in what sense, how does somebody get there? And I guess it must be through the artifacts that they've encountered. I don't know, is that, perhaps maybe that's just a simple explanation and we can move on, but I don't know, it was just something that was on my mind.
Well, it seems to me that you've made two interesting points there, Nick. One, you know, we certainly seem to be saying that ideology can be sort of like manifested through what we put out. You know, Radias keeps mentioning movies, or advertising, or those sorts of things. That's sort of like a representation of our ideology. It's not clear which one comes first, but it's there at least. And then you also mentioned, well, the interesting thing about ideology is that it can cause us to act in certain ways. So I guess I would really ask, you know, which is it? You know, is it both at the same time, or, you know, is it more determined? Is the way we act more representative of our ideology, or the things we produce that are representative of it? Does that make sense?
My brain hurts right now. I'm still getting over my jet lag. But just to go back to, like, this the idea of replicating memes, I know that Mike and Nick, you were with me a couple weeks ago at the, you know, research fair thingy that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And I just went to an academic conference, right, and it's just, you know, the intention is good, but it's just too many, it's like too many people, too much, that the thing that I walked away with that was valuable was nothing like from like the content of a paper, but a question that was asked afterwards. Like, that's what stuck with me, a question. My point being is that, like, going back to Mike's question about, well, what is it first, action, ideology, how do they interact? And you could see, like, with this research fair and with academic conferences, like, this is what people do. Like, they acclimate themselves to the form. And unless you have, like, a band of freaks who are energetic enough to say, no, you know, we're not going to do it this way, it will continue that way. So it, you know, you can be motivated. It's very rare that you find people who do that, and because it's hard, it takes a lot of energy, and most people are content to like act in the form. And it's so funny because talking to people, and especially the young people at this conference I was just at, they were like, "This sucks." Like, this is not what I was expecting. And I was pointing out, well, you know, you need to have a haunted house or something. And one girl said that she, because of this conference, she's not going, she's a graduate student, she's not going to go into academia. So I just wanted to use it as a concrete example, because I know that both Mike and Nick know, because they sat there with me, what it's like to be at a quote-unquote research and creativity fair. And we all agreed that, you know, it's suboptimal. Yet, everybody does it, and we have the idea to try to change it. The question is, will we? Probably not.
That's true hope. And the thing about ideology, you guys, is so fascinating. The variable that Hope was talking about, replication, it replicates itself in media artifacts, but it also replicates itself within institutions. It replicates itself within human beings. So whatever the ideology is that you're seeing on the tube, or you're reading in a book, or things of that nature, is that thought process. The artifact, it's almost like it replicates some type of consciousness that gets transferred over to your consciousness that makes people act, and it replicates itself in institutions, school, government, and so on and so forth. It replicates itself within individuals, and they become the ambassadors for the ideology, the thought process, the emotional aspect of the ideology premise. So it's very, very fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Mike, I don't know if I answered your question by bringing up that example at all.
Well, I don't know if you did, but I think at least it illustrates. I guess what I mean to say is, I don't know that, you know, that there is an answer. I think there's a we can point to examples of one or the other, you know, in which case, let me just be clear, I'll be careful, as Nick was saying last week. There are clear cases in which we act a certain way in response to sort of like materialized ideology, you know, when we start listening to a specific kind of music or, you know, quoting movie lines or I don't know if I can think of a better example than that. But there are also clearly cases in which, you know, we put it the other way around, in which I think the example Nick wanted to use last week was Nick, what's the name of that movie? I can't remember. The McCandless Story?
Into the Wild.
Right.
That's actually a book, but the movie's really good, too. They're
okay,
both good.
Fair enough. I think the idea where you were going with that was, look, you know, it's certainly possible to address the powers that be or the institution or the existing norms and ideology of our culture and say, look, you know, screw this. So, I mean, we can point to examples of either. Which should it be? I think that's a philosophical question in itself.
Mm. And people do turn away from it. We turn away from it. We're talking about it right now. But I think the majority of people don't because I'll give an example of advertising, and there are many other examples, but, like, you see the billboard that plays upon your emotion of inadequacy in some way, shape, or form. You're not sure whether you're going to buy into that, but you start walking around and you start seeing people carrying the artifact that was showed on the tangible media artifact. You see the purse and you see it everywhere, and then you go somewhere and you hear someone talking about it. You see what I'm saying? That's mm-hmm. part of the programming. It literally jumps off the media artifact and becomes a part of the real world, and you see it everywhere, and then you feel like, in order for me to fit in or things of this nature, I have to get this object in order to fulfill that need. Even if you're not feeling that way in the beginning, you will eventually feel that way because people will talk about it, people will wear it, you'll see it more and more and more. People will judge you by it.
All right, well, I guess to kind of, I don't know if this is going to contradict that exactly that, but it's kind of playing the other side, I guess. And this goes back to a more fundamental way, I think, of looking at Mike's question of which is operating on what, the ideology and the action, or is it the action that determines the ideology? I don't have the book in front of me, but William James kind of talks about acting or feeling how you act. So, like, you can actually dictate your feelings by acting a certain way or not acting on a particular feeling. So, actually, like, the actions, I believe that this is kind of what he was saying. I'll have to look it up again. But in this sense, it's my belief that it definitely can go either way, but that the actions are actually what really in the end matter. Because, I mean, there's so many times where I'm like, man, I would really like to say these things to this person for these reasons, but when I look at it, I'm like, well, this would be an emotional response that probably wouldn't have the best outcome considering, you know, I'm, you know, emotional in a certain way or whatever. So I dictate the way my actions are, and as a consequence, my feelings kind of come around to where my actions are. So, you know, it's an interesting thing of looking at it from the parallel of how one, an emotional response versus how one acts in response to their emotions. In my mind, I guess, I think actions are the overriding factor, and that one can choose one's actions over what, I guess, an ideology or a feeling.
I would also like connect that with existentialist philosophy. And Sartre in particular, who says, you know, it's one thing to say, like, I value education, for example. But, like, to truly value education is to have one's actions be concordant with that. So that means, like, you spend your time studying. And it's through action that one's values are expressed and actually realized. Because by actually saying, okay, I value education, therefore I'm going to study, and by continuing to do that, you develop a routine and a habit, and it becomes internalized, and it becomes a part of you, and I'll just leave it at that, but it's like the action is intimately connected with value, And it's hard because at some points you have to push yourself or you have to say no to yourself. And that involves,
right.
you know, moving your body towards something in the case of pushing or, you know, holding back on doing something. And it's that conscious choice of doing that that does, and that goes back to overcoming ideology, and it's like the will. And you and people who talk about the will talk about it as a muscle, but it's a potential in everybody, but it must be exercised, and it's painful to exercise it. And that's why people don't do it.
And I think this leads really nicely into kind of the third kind of progression of the original thought for this show is how does this ideology and this culture inform identity, or how does identity inform culture and stuff? So I really think the existentialist point of Sartre, I don't know how to pronounce his name, as you put
me
it.
Me neither.
As you put it, that the it's actually what you do that informs who you are. That is your external existence within the world. It's your interaction that I guess is in a sense real. Versus, you can in your mind have all these great ideas and all these great. I have a friend; he's brilliant. Has all these ideas. He always tells me about them, and he's 25 years old and hasn't done a single one of them. So it's like, you got to ask at the end of the day, I don't know. It's frustrating,
here,
I guess.
Here, brother.
Am I referring to my brother?
No, I'm giving props, points. Here, brother. Like what you're saying.
Oh, yeah. I got you.
Oh,
yeah, it just kind of coincided with what I was.
Okay, so we've got about 4 minutes left. Please reiterate. It sounds like we've come to the conclusion that there's some sort of close relationship between culture and ideology. It seems like culture is sort of a vehicle for ideology, and possibly even the aim that culture tries to arrive at, that ideology is like some decidedly good thing we agree upon, whether it's good or not, a whole different question. And then we seem to be in this discussion about how ideology affects identity, and it seems to play a very crucial role, at least societal ideology, informing our sort of initial human software, I think we wanted to call it, sort of like help fuel our predisposition and give us norms and ethics to build off of. But it seems just now as though Hope and Nick are saying that identity is resilient even in the face of ideology. It can certainly seem as though identity is the creature of ideology, but we still have this conscious ability that we can sort of walk away from it or question it or, is there any other way you guys would like to characterize it?
I know, I like that. I use the word sculpt occasionally.
Sculpt, right.
You can sculpt yourself through the will can sculpt its identity. I would say that.
I would also like to point out, as we mentioned, there's no thing that, or I'm pretty sure she said this, that there's no thing that is all positive or all negative. So ideology can also very much inform the identity to which the person's identity becomes the prevailing ideology, and whether that's Nazi Germany or some utopia, I don't know.
Right.
But
right.
In a sense, I don't think that we think that is good if you just acquiesce to what the majority ideology is. I think that would include a loss of one's identity. I don't know if we want to stretch that far, but...
Well, I think the distinction that's made clear there, Nick, is autonomy versus automaton, and I think that's a distinction you wanted to make last week, but sort of the exercising of this will, or I guess even like a prescription of identity, is an act of autonomy.
Can I just...
Sorry, go ahead.
I just feel compelled, sorry. Like, I forget whether it's the red pill or the blue pill, but the guy Cypher in The Matrix,
right.
Like, he chooses to be an automaton. So, one question is that truly, being autonomous if you choose to be an automaton? And I would say, no. I just want to say that. I just want to say that there's that question lingering, and that's a... That's another topic, I know, but...
Aw, man, Hope.
Sorry.
And I think that also brings up the question, which I think was also in The Matrix, was, is ignorance bliss or not? Because I've heard arguments both ways, and I think there's definitely some interesting things to be said there.
Unfortunately, once again, we've run out of time. But we're left with some great questions about autonomy and automatons. And I think we've made it clear that exercising free will is what makes autonomy. This has been Ethical Talk. We'd like to thank you for joining us, and hopefully we can pick up with a great conversation next week. Thanks, everybody.
Good night.
Have a good one.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.